about Palestine in the time of Christ. We have not the time to go through all the panorama of the events of history that have preceded it. But during the ministry of the man Christ Jesus, we have the embodiment of God, Messiah, the King, moving among his people, speaking, proclaiming, opening the eyes of the blind, unstopping deaf ears, performing miracles that even Rome, even with its casual first approach to his ministry, have had to record as recorded events, testified to and borne testimony to, both to their procurator in the city of Jerusalem, but to the many that they sent over to investigate these matters and of Palestine. The fact remains that the thing that remained a mystery, even to Rome, was the hatred and the animosity of official Jewry in the city of Palestine against a man who, by their records and all that they had been able to glean as they searched the land of Palestine, had been to do good unto those that needed his healing hand, to speak words which spiritually gave life and hope to a people. And in all of these, Rome's verdict also was, we see no reason why there was such animosity against this individual. But in the land of Palestine, these things you must know. First, the land of Palestine was under the conquest of Rome, a Roman province. The continual administration of Rome over this province was constant from the hour of its first conquest until the days when the disintegration of the very province itself took place under Titus the Roman. Also, it is to be known that the land of Jerusalem operated under what was called a theocracy. It was the principal processes of Rome to grant a freedom of internal administration to the provinces if they had such forms of government. The land of Palestine, there had been a re-entrance into the land by the two tribes of Judah and Benjamin. They wanted to rebuild the city of Jerusalem, and this had taken place, as you know earlier, during the days when in Medo-Persia they left in Artaxerxes, and other forces which had been friendly to the children of Judah and Benjamin were all in favor of their going back to their own homeland to rebuild Judah, the land of Palestine and Jerusalem proper. With them came a mixed multitude, an unassimilatable people that had no part nor lot with the house of Judah or Benjamin, the same evil power that dominated ancient Babylon and had moved to Pergamos to establish there its headquarters and control. Here it is that Jesus talks to the church of Pergamos through the lips and vision of John when he points out Pergamos in Revelation and says, "This is where Satan's seat is." It was here the house of Anus, the house of Herod, and other powers had extended their authority and their manipulation through their money control over Rome itself, and had bought and gained control of the kingship of the province underneath the Roman governor and true creator, and thus Herod, king of the Jews, had become king over the land of Palestine, and of course, as you know, was on the throne at the time of the birth of Christ. The house of Herod was to retain administration even after the death of this Herod, as Herod II also, the Tetrarch later as he was known, retains administration and has this administration as king even at the time of Christ's trial. It's a rather significant thing that the temple of Jerusalem was controlled by a high priesthood. It must be understood that from the days of Moses that Israel were ruled with a supreme court which was made up of 71 personages. This Supreme Court, even in the time of the kingdom, which existed during the time of Saul, of David, and of Solomon, was the real authority for the prosecution and for the hearing of any cases that faced either capital offenses or even lesser offenses under various areas of this administration. Now, this was not a Jewish court. This was a court of your race that operated with the highest standards of jurisprudence and functioned both in civil and spiritual law, and was recognized by the kingdom as a high administration, and an appeal could always be carried through the priesthood to this court on any matter. The fact remains that it was later, after the dispersion of 10 tribes of Israel in captivity, and then Judah and Benjamin in their captivity in the days of Nebuchadnezzar, that this court did not operate for a period of time until Judah and Benjamin returned to build the city of Jerusalem. Then this evil mixed multitude out to the land of the Herodians from Pergamos, and those that attached themselves to the returning groups of Judah and Benjamin associated themselves with the rebuilding of the city of Jerusalem. But during that time, there was a division among the people. The theology of Palestine was divided among the people that make up Judah and Benjamin. If we were to identify these peoples today in their second migrations, we would call them the Normans and the Germanic peoples whose coming into Europe was exactly timed with their exodus before the fall of Jerusalem in 70 A.D. It's a significant thing that when we refer to these peoples, we note that Judah and Benjamin had a historic background behind them. They had the faith and the religion which had been given from the days of Moses and had its foundation in the earlier migrations and history of our race as patriarchs whose experience with God is a matter of Old Testament history. These people, known as Pharisees, believed in many deep truths. They believed in the perfection. They believed in the laws of God. They believed, therefore, in what was known as the written law, and they believed in also what was known as the oral law. The oral law was not always oral in the fact that it did not have written foundation, but the writings of the prophets such as Isaiah, Jeremiah, and others were added to the knowledge of the law, and the spiritual covenants and promises were also a part of their aspirations, set up the formation and vision of their hopes and expectations. Thus it was also that the advice of the ecclesiastical leaders, which made up the oral law, was called at one time the Mishnah, still is called such even under false misuse today. And so the Pharisees were believers in the resurrection. This was not discussed too much by Moses in the time of his writing, but was discussed by Job, who preceded it, and by the other prophets who had faith in its expectation. So the Pharisees were resurrectionists. And they also believed and taught in the law of God, the hope of God, the eventual kingdom, the sovereignty of the white race, and the ultimate things which God was going to develop through it. The division of the two kingdoms that happened in the days of Jeroboam and their spread through captivity, and the reaching of the 10 tribes of Israel in Western Europe had not warmed up the Pharisees of Judah and Benjamin too much to the portion of the kingdom that had long since departed in the days of Solomon's son Rehoboam. But that destiny was also to be reunited in a rather distinct way. As we go into the background of this, there were another group of people also present inside of Palestine. They were called the Sadducees. Who were they? The Sadducees were made up of Hittites, Canaanites, Amalekites, Herodians, Hasdians, and these people were not the descendants of Abraham at all. But they called themselves by identity Jews, and the peoples that lived in the land under their proclamation were called Jews, though the word Jew came from the word Yehudin originally and meant a cursing. The fact remains that these people, being Sadducees, had come out of the background of the pagan philosophies which affected India and other parts of the earth, for they had helped to dominate and build these religions and were ardently incarnationists, operating with a concept that it made no difference what transpired, they would return to get hold of the wealth they accumulated and the power which they gained, and therefore they would even spend their lives for this conquest of power, but had no spiritual, moral, or ethical obligations to anything but their creed of gaining power. They formed a part of the Luciferian descendancy. They were not descendants of Abraham, though they had called themselves Jews and attached themselves to this strange theocracy that was existing in Palestine. Under Roman law, why it was essential that all branches of theology that were represented among them as scribes or as teachers or as masters, Jesus said he liked to be called rabbis and seen in the marketplace and praised of men, and this is the amount of your religion and your faith, and he tells them much concerning their attitude in this matter. But the fact remains that they desired to gain control of this temple theocracy, which had an absolute authority under Rome. So in this instance, the Sadducees came in and they demanded seats upon the Sanhedrin. Let me declare to you that the Sanhedrin originally, in its Israelitish background and in the background of your race, had 71 judges upon it. These men were not only supposed to be experts at theology and experts at the law as had been given by God as a mandate to your race in moral and ethical and sociological problems and in spiritual application. They must have been men of good repute. They must have been selected by the people for their high standing in the community of the various provinces of your land, and at that time were elevated to this court by general selection. Now the fact remains that once such a Sanhedrin was established, it had been perpetuated throughout time by replacement with men selected by the Sanhedrin, the priesthood, for their continuity in carrying out these high standards. It is also a matter that under the great Sanhedrin was a lesser Sanhedrin composed of 23 men. These 23 men could hear cases as it related to capital punishment for crimes that involved violence against fellow men where death was the result, and this was called the Lesser Sanhedrin. They could not sit upon a theological crime that related, however, to blasphemy. Then there was the third group. The third group involved just three men. They were called the Lesser Court. They only sat upon the lesser grievances that involved petty thefts and things of this nature. But all of them comprised the complete Sanhedrin. Now, throughout course in time, this had been the process of law. When Rome, however, had permitted the administration inside of Palestine to remain at the temple level and that the Sanhedrin could meet on the high courts of the hill, there was soon a request upon the part of the Herodians, these false non-Israelites, which Jesus was to identify, and we'll show you with the scriptures which we shall use in a few minutes. They demanded that their Sanhedrin, that they have an equal share in the seats of the Sanhedrin according to their number. And so Rome said, all right, according to your representation, ye claim that ye also are scribes, doctors, and teachers of the law coming out of the same background. Therefore, we demand that it be a democratic process so that you have your seats on the Sanhedrin. Now, under Israelitish law, when if it were not for the conquest of Rome, they would have deported all these people as undesirable and never have permitted them to have any political power whatsoever inside of their land. Someday we're going to get smart, and two, we're going to deport out of America this undesirable, unassimilatable people that are still at the same job they were at in the days of Jesus. In the midst of this, however, when the Sanhedrin was thus composed, the Pharisees still were the majority. The Sadducees did not have sufficient numbers. They could not capture an election. They could not appoint for themselves a high priest. It happened, however, they had been planning for some time to attain this power. And so one man whose province was influence was great and had many servants and a mighty household, a Sadducean of the house of Hasdrubal. And he also, being a relative by marriage to the house of Canaan, which were actually Canaanites and Norway's the one, and desired to gain control of the temple, said, I will do this. I will pull out of the Sanhedrin, pull out of the Sadducees, and proclaim myself a Pharisee. I will tell the world that I accept the principle of the Pharisees, believe in resurrection, the law of Moses, and that I believe in the great vision and spiritual and oral law as well as the written one. So then that will number me in my household as Sadducees, or as Pharisees, and it will raise the number of the Pharisees in the Sanhedrin, which they will have to then select for my house. So they thought this was a pretty good strategy, and it was a cheap Jewish trick anyhow, and that was to proclaim that he was something he was not in order to gain political power, and this they did. And so we have a word in our English language that has come down from that day to this. The word is shame. It comes from the word of the name of the man's household, Shema. But there was no higher shame than a person who had declared himself to be theologically that which he was not in order to gain power over the house of God, in order to destroy and conquer it and reduce it to slavery. Thus it was the false Sadducees with Roman prestige were seated in the Sanhedrin, now as Pharisees. And when the election came in 7 AD, they elected Annas, high priest. And he became high priest of Canaanites, and the Sadducees won an election because the false Pharisees, who were Canaanites at heart, had elected their own high priest. They then increased the number with each including priest, because all of the previous priests of the upper echelon of the ruling house were therefore members, in fact, all of the great Sanhedrin, adding their numbers, that by the time of Christ there was 12 numbers added to the 71. This made 83 members that had voting power in the Sanhedrin, supposedly only by Mosaic law to be 71, and these 83 were there at the time of the trial of Christ. I want you to know that all during the ministry of Christ, we are confused sometimes in the King James Version, not in original text, but by the design of those that help with this translation to confuse your faith and your race. We are confused by the continual reference to various peoples by names which are confusing. In fact, the Pharisees, many times under their criticism, should have been translated by original Aramaic text, and we see this also from the early Alexandrian text, as Shema Pharisees, or false Pharisees. The true Pharisees had a different outlook with the true theologians of the time. In fact, the temple had not only been taken over during the time of Christ's early boyhood, but by the time of his ministry was dominated by these Canaanite priests. It was not only dominated, but they had turned it into a house of merchandise. They were using fraudulent processes and even selling the animals for sacrifice. They were exploiting people. They were changing and shortchanging them. They were involved in an international banking program on the very steps of the temple. And they were charging and lending money at usurious rates, all of which Christ identified when during his ministry he turned and said, he had made my father's house a den of robbers, murderers, and thieves. And he drove the money changers out of the temple. The fact remains that this happened in numerous occasions, but operated under the license of this strange and pagan priesthood. Still, the theology of Israel carried on. There was one young teacher who was a brilliant master and was known as Nicodemus, and he taught in a school of thought that was one of the dividing phases of Israel's theology. Two men taught. One was called Gamaliel, and the other was taught Nicodemus, who had the theological students in that part of the court of the temple where they assembled to be instructed. Gamaliel was a great and honest man, but his philosophies as it related to the thinking of the people was that the grace of God would reach down to forgive violations of the law, and that the processes of his spirit would bring about proper repentance because he was God. Nicodemus also was an honest man. He belonged to another school of theology, even among the Pharisees, which taught that the individual would have to make certain decisions, accept the same principles, or otherwise he might be cast out into some area where it would be impossible to discover him. If we were to identify them today, we would have said Nicodemus was a Methodist, and we would have said that Gamaliel was a Calvinist or a Baptist, because their theology was related to the issues of grace. The Apostle Paul was taught originally even in his own area of the kingdom under Gamaliel, and later when he became an ardent Christian, you remember that his doctrines were filled with the grace and the background, the influence of the teachings of Gamaliel. Add this to the Apocrypha, which later was the book which he wrote, the Apocalypse of Paul, from his heavenly experience, and you will see where he had the background of the things he wrote for us in the epistles. Now we remember this, that these masters of Israel saw Jesus daily coming and going from Jerusalem. They heard the words that he said. And what he said was in actual fulfillment of the prophecies they had heard. At one time they were gathered together, and you will read in your scriptures that that he was speaking in a certain house. And we are told that they were men of law, doctors of law, scribes and Pharisees from all over Palestine, in every portion and out of every city. These doctors of the law came to hear and to see what he would do. So this had been a summed up meeting by the Pharisees to evaluate the Messiahship of Jesus. It was at that meeting that the roof was taken off of the building, and a man was lowered down in front of Christ because the press of the crowd was so great that no one could even get into the buildings but those that were already there. It was here that Jesus turned to this man and said unto him, "Thy sins be forgiven thee." But before this he says, "Rise and take up thy bed and walk." And when they saw him get up and take up his bed and walk, why, the great challenge that came out of the Pharisees is, "Who is this man that can do this?" Jesus had said, "Thy sins be forgiven thee." They did not like that. When he says, "Rise and take up thy bed and walk," they were challenged by the miracle. He turned to them and said, "Now which is it easier for me to say, 'Thy sins be forgiven thee,' or to tell him to rise and take up his bed and walk?" For this was the revelation of Messiah, with even the grace which Yahweh alone could have to transgression. Now the true Pharisees sat here that day. They beheld these things, and the scripture said, having beheld this miracle, they marveled, and they went each man to his own home and said, "We have seen great things today." But with each rising miracle, with each new instance of his power, the animosity of the Jews that controlled the temple increased. They dominated the Sanhedrin, and they now were faced with the fact that now a Messiah, one which they thought in the days of Herod they might have captured or killed, or when the armies of the Jews marched down to Bethlehem and killed the babies. Now they were aware he was alive. Now they knew that the people were listening to him. What was the attitude of ecclesiastical Jewry? Giving lip service to the laws of Moses, but operating under the pattern of the laws of ancient Babylon. I would that you, each one, were able to take down these passages as we give them, because we shall show you the position of how this thing happened. Now we are told in the 14th, in the 22nd chapter of Matthew, that the Pharisees, Shema Pharisees, the false Pharisees, who were actually Sadducees, took counsel how they would try to entangle Christ in his talk. This would be so they could accuse him and destroy. This is the 22nd chapter of Matthew, the 15th verse. So they took counsel how they might entangle him in his talk. This was only one phase of the conspiracy. Jesus understood exactly what they were doing, knowing every thought in their mind. In the 23rd chapter of Matthew, he said, "I know who you are. You love the uppermost seats and rooms at the feast. You want the chief seats in the synagogue. You like the greetings in the marketplaces. You like to be called Rabbi, Rabbi. But be ye not called Rabbi, for only one is the Master, which is Christ." Therefore, again, Jesus speaks to them. He says, "Therefore, woe unto you, scribes, Shema Pharisees, false Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye not only are the devourer of women's houses through your usury, but you make a pretense of long prayers, only shall you receive the greater damnation. Woe unto you, scribes, Pharisees, and hypocrites, for ye encompass the sea and the land, to make one proselyte to your faith, and when ye make him, he is twofold more the child of hell than yourselves. Woe unto you, blind guides, which say, whatsoever sweareth by the temple, it is nothing, but whosoever sweareth by gold, now it has authority. Ye fools, ye blind, which is greater, the gold or the temple? Whosoever shall swear by the altar, it is nothing, but whosoever shall swear by some gift to the priesthood, oh, he has power." Jesus said, "Ye fools." For therefore, identifying them, he continues to say, Woe unto you, scribes, Pharisees, and false hypocrites, ye pay tithes, and ye exact law and judgment, and ye leave what ye declare not being undone, but ye strain it a gnat and swallow it a camel, and your judgment is evil. Ye blind guides, he said, woe unto you. Therefore he continues to say, you are like white sepulchres, which indeed appear beautiful outwardly, but within are full of dead men's bones from your own uncleanliness. Even so ye also outwardly appear righteous unto men, but ye are filled with hypocrisy and iniquity. Woe unto you, because you built the tombs of the prophets, and ye garnished the sepulchres of the righteous. And then they answered and they said, if we had lived in the days of our fathers, we wouldn't have killed the prophets. We wouldn't have destroyed the righteous, and we wouldn't have spilled their righteous blood. Then Jesus said, you have just borne witness of yourselves before these people that you're the children of the prophet killers. You're Canaanites, you're Hittites, you're Amalekites, you're not the house of Abraham. You've just borne witness by your very words. Yes, and we hear the same words today from the Nye Brith as it sends out its publications. If we had lived in the day of Jesus, we wouldn't have crucified Christ. No, they would measure up the full measure of their fathers, for they would crucify the whole Christian world with their communist revolution. I turn here now to the words of Jesus, and he said, therefore ye bear witness against yourselves that you're the children of those that killed the prophets. And Jesus said, fill ye then the measure of your fathers. This ye will do. You are the serpents. You are the generation of the viper. How can ye escape the judgment? Behold, I sent prophets and wise men and scribes. Some ye kill, some ye crucify. Some ye scourge, or ye deliver them up in your synagogues, or you persecute them. Upon you is the judgment of all the righteous blood that has been slain upon the earth, from the blood of righteous Abel unto Zacharias, the son of Barachias, whom you slew between the temple and the altar. Verily I say, all these things in judgment come on this generation, this progeny. You are the descendants of Cain, the murderer of Abel, and guilty of every massacre and every assassination of that which is right from that day to this one. Now, in their attempt to challenge Jesus, they challenge the omniscient incarnate Messiah, who knew every one of them and who they were, and identified the Jews that controlled the temple of Jerusalem were Canaanites and not Israelites, were the enemies of the kingdom, and they had stolen this power. Now let us note the nature of these people in the face of the miracles and the continued good which Christ would perform. For there is no process that is more clear than this situation. After Jesus had made this announcement, we read these words, the 26th chapter of the book of Matthew. And it came to pass that when Jesus had finished all these sayings, and this had come to pass, he said to his disciples, you know that after 2 days will come the feast of the Passover, and the Son of Man is going to be betrayed and crucified. And it says here that there was assembled together in their upper room the chief priests and the scribes, the elders of the people, and they were at the palace of the high priest, which is called Caiaphas. And they consulted how they might take Jesus by subtlety and killing. Hear these words now. Never not a process of just law, not a process of natural jurisprudence, but a conspiracy in the high priest's house, not having yet had a trial. These people that were later going to preside over his trial had plotted how they might take him by subtlety and how they might kill him. Now I want to call this to your attention. Put that down in the 26th chapter of Matthew, and you'll read this from the first to the fourth verses. I go a little farther back in the record of this design, for they wanted to entrap him and entangle him in his cough. They wanted to take him by subtlety, and they had designed to kill him. More than that, they had hired a little rascal of their own kind and had him attach himself to Christ everywhere he went. So the Christ's disciples, who were Galileans and who were true men of Judah as well, and traveled throughout the land of Palestine with him, and there was one that followed everywhere, and always offered his services at every opportunity, and all the time Jesus knew himself, knew that he was a man that would fulfill a part in destiny, and he let this man become one of the 12. And right away he demonstrated his affinity. He said, oh, I carry the money bag. Always we find him. Got his hand on the money sack, in the money sack. Every time he saw anything that cost a little money and he didn't control it, he worried about it. Even when a gift of precious ointment was poured over Christ, he said, how much was it worth and why is it in my sack? Well, there's something about these people. They have an affinity to this, and it identifies them throughout time and throughout every place they might go. But Jesus was also aware that this fellow was dipping in the bag, and he knew also that he was running over here to the temple and getting together with the ADL that day, and he was telling them what was going on among the disciples. You say, how do you know this? You turn now to the sixth chapter of the book of Job. Here in this record, in the sixth chapter of the book of Job, and in the closing verses, Jesus makes an identification here, which is of great importance. He declares to the disciples, now I think you should know, for I have chosen you 12, and one of you is a devil. A person stopped and asked me as they went out today, was it true there was only one Jew among Jesus' disciples? That's right, only one of them. Jesus said, I have chosen you 12, and one of you is a devil. Now I point this out to you. This is the 71st verse of the 6th chapter of John. And here is the next verse in the 7th chapter. And after these things, after Jesus identified the cool agent of the temple, after these things, Jesus walked in Galilee because he could not walk among Jewry because the Jews sought to kill him. He could not walk among Jewry because the Jews sought to kill him. And it tells us in this 7th chapter that when Jesus went down to Galilee, he went down among his brethren and his family and his friends. There were no Jews down inside of Galilee, and Galilee was where the patriots were, and Galilee was where the zealots came from, and Galilee knew what was going on, and even Rome knew that down in Galilee was the resistance. And you will find in the records that every once in a while, angered by the Jewish revolution, and angered by the patriots in Galilee, that even Pilate sacrificed once in a while a Galilean upon the altars mixed with the sacrifices in Jerusalem. Now, Galilee was the resistance, but it was not Jewish. Will know that as Jesus was down in Galilee, the one place where he had security as far as observation from the enemy was here. When he returned back to Jerusalem, it was at the time of the feast. One of the remarkable things about the events of this time was that when Jesus came down to the feast, one of the things that had happened just previous to this had been the fact that Lazarus, which was Jesus' friend, had died. And after 6 days, Jesus came to Bethany where Lazarus was, and he raised Lazarus from the dead. And when he called Lazarus out, and the miracle was recorded by Rome, and all the land of Palestine just started to buzz with it, the Jews had agents stand by, and they were amazed when they saw the resurrection of Lazarus. They ran back to the high priest. They said, when this gets over the land, he's going to take over. And they plotted, it says here in the scripture, how to put Lazarus to death again. Can you think of anybody so utterly vile and evil in their thinking that after the miracle of God raising a man from the dead, that their hatred against the righteousness and miracle displayed was so great they wanted to kill the man all over again? I think you get a little picture of the soul of your enemy. It's a rather interesting thing. Then they sent their spies around Jesus, and in the record of the 7th chapter of the book of John, we read concerning this, that the Pharisees and the people murmured concerning the things which Christ said and the miracles which he had done. And so the chief priests and the false Pharisees sent officers of their army to take him. Under Roman law, they were allowed an army. This army could be as many as 3,000. At this time, about 1,600 were operating under the army of the temple, and mostly under the command of certain scribes who were also officers of law. It is to be known that the Palestinian army under the procurator at that time, who was none other than Pontius Pilate, numbered about 7,000 men in the garrisons of Rome. However, we read here that the Pharisees, the false Pharisees and chief priests, sent out officers to take Jesus. And Jesus saw them, and he said, yet a little while I'm here, and then I go unto the celestial, or Adranumos, under the spirit that holds together the heavens and the earth. I go into the plane of spirit. Now, ye shall seek me, he said, but you're not going to find me, and where I go you cannot come. Now, I like this passage, because I know, want you to know that while they were trying to pre-try Christ, it proved certain things. You'll never have to worry, you'll never find a Jew in heaven. Someone said, how do you know? Because Jesus proved it. He said, you're going to search for me, but where I go, you cannot come. Now, then said the Jews, where can he go in the earth, or where shall he go to, that we will not find him? They had great faith in the ADL in that day. They said, there's no place he can go to that we will find him. Our pool is everywhere. Where can he go that we will not find him? Then they admitted that they knew that the tribes of Israel were in Ephraim and were in Britain and in Western Europe. They said, now just where would they go? Do you suppose that he'll go out among the ethnos of the nations and the dispersed in these nations and teach them? The dispersed meant those who had been of the 10 tribes that had come through the passes and settled in Europe. That's one place they knew they couldn't go, because in Anglo-Saxonism and in the heart of Germany, it was not permitted for its Jew to enter. Now, they not only admit this, that, but as Jesus continues to speak, why, the soldiers sent out to seize him, suddenly in fear, go back to the temple. I quote now John in the 8th chapter. And the Pharisees and chief officers, came out that east, they said, where is he? Why didn't you bring him? Then they said, well, first, there never was a man that spoke like this man. He paralyzed us while he spoke. We were afraid to touch him. Besides the people were spellbound by his word. People were on his side. The right wing was waking up, and it wouldn't be safe to take him away from the right wing. Then the rulers said, have any of the prominent Pharisees breathed on him? And the soldiers, not being theologians, couldn't answer. No, they said, it's this people that don't understand these fine points of our law, and they're just the masses, cursed already, to be ruled by us forever. And so, therefore, don't worry too much about them, but we've got to be subtle about it. Then Nicodemus, the theological professor who had a right to sit in the Sanhedrin as a teacher and as a member of it, having been there that day because he taught on the steps of the temple, and when they held these impromptu sessions, well, he could slide in where others didn't. And he said, now, just a moment. Does our law condemn any man before his hearers? They turned and said, are you so a Galilean? Are you one of those? You're not a Jew then. Search and see if any prophet comes out of Galilee. We're Jews. He's not a Jew. You're not one either then. Thank God he's not a Jew. If God was a Jew, there would be nothing left but to commit suicide. And it was Nicodemus who came to Jesus by night. Says, does our law judge any man before it hears him? They said, so you're also a Galilean. And every man went into his own house. Among the mysteries of the strategy that was to follow, we discover that they had long plotted in the capture of Jesus. Their desire to take him and to hold him prisoner and then try him before the hours of the assembled peoples at the Passover were many. We are to discover, therefore, that after the recognition that Christ was not going to join them and they couldn't make him submit and that his miracles were greater than they could contend with, they said, we've got to kill him. And they plotted with subtlety how to put him to death, as we read to you.